Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, July 1st, 2003. Today's session is entitled For the Healing and Health of Congregations, a session presented by Paul Rohde, number ROP 2003-01. Let's listen in.
And before that, I was a parish pastor for 20 years. I'm looking forward to this as a discussion under the theme for the healing of the world that is ready to focus on the healing of the church. One of the things that has been part of Holden Village's mission since its beginning is the renewal of the church. And I want to say that between renewal and health and healing is a short step. I hope we can garner some insights from one another and have some good discussion around that today. I think for starters, I'll begin by confessing a couple of my fears about what this session might become. And by way of doing that, just to admit to you that I'm a recovering debater. I debated all 4 years of high school and 3 years of college. And a debater never starts a speech without defining his or her terms. And so I thought it might be good to define some terms as we start, and around that, give me a chance to express some of my fears about where I think we could get stuck in ways that would not be either healthy or healing. So for starters, let's define the term church. I'm not going to assume that all of you are Lutheran. I am, and I hope you can get past that if you're not. But in my heritage, which is Lutheranism, we define the church around word and sacrament, which is to say, when we speak of a congregation, we speak of a gathering of people, but it's not just any gathering of people. Every time Augustana College gets together, they are church, but they understand themselves as church only insofar as word and sacrament define, shape, somehow articulate their becoming. Now, having said that, the church, at least in part of Christianity's self-understanding, congregations are people gathered around word and sacrament. Let's read a couple passages from the Bible. First, from Galatians chapter 1, thinking about word. I am astonished that you are so quickly deserting the one who has called you in the grace of Christ and are turning to a different gospel. We could read to a different word. Before Paul gets through this chapter, he's going to say, you foolish Galatians, who has bewitched you that you would betray the word? I mean, the interesting thing about being church is that we define ourselves as word, and yet in the very scripture, we've got this church in Galatia that seems to have given up the word. And then let's go to 1 Corinthians in the interest of sacrament. We define ourselves as congregations gathering around sacrament. But in 1 Corinthians 11, Paul writes this. When you come together, it is not really to eat the Lord's supper. For when the time comes to eat, each of you goes ahead with your own supper, and one goes hungry, and another becomes drunk. What? Do you not have homes to eat and drink in? Or do you show contempt for the church of God and humiliate those who have nothing? What should I say to you? Should I commend you? In this matter, I do not commend you, for I received from the Lord Jesus what I handed on to you, and so on. So here we have another church in Corinth that, though we want to say sacrament, Lord's Supper is the very center of what makes us church, was not holding sacrament intentionally. So what do we say about church? One of my fears is that we would come together to talk about the healing of congregations and presuppose that there was some golden age back in the first century or maybe in 1950 when the church was really healthy and really whole and really wonderful. And I would have to say, as a facilitator of this conversation, in that I do not commend you. There's always been this tension, at least as I read the scripture, and as I read the history of Christian church, this tension between what we claim as gathered people of God, as Lutherans around word and sacrament, and as what we are. On the one hand, people of word, on the other hand, people who get pulled around all different sorts of messages and get that message distorted and sometimes appear to think there is a different gospel. Around sacrament, and at the same time acknowledging that from the time of the Corinthian congregation, there are factions, divisions, and when there are, Paul says, it's not the Lord's Supper that you eat, which is to say, there's been dis-ease, distress, dissonance in the Christian church from the very beginning. So one of my fears is that we not fall prey to some sort of nostalgia that says there was a day when the church was somehow healthy. But rather to say we have a healing God who is persistent among communities that do not fully live out of this. So first of all, we've defined church. The other terms I want us to define are hell and healing, because I think they're different words. I happen to think that we're influenced in our conversation around healing by medicine and practices of medicine that define themselves pathologically, which is to say that it's interesting in conversations, even though we say we want to talk about health and healing, that we really end up talking more about sickness than we do about healing. And that's somewhere where I start to hear a difference and want to claim a difference, that when we think of the church and we think about healing, we give ourselves room also to think about being healthy. Now, one of the gifts that St. Paul has given us is that he compares the church or congregations to the body. He says Christ is the head, and the arm cannot say to the foot, you're not part of the body. The eye cannot say to the ear, you're not part of the body. I think that helps me want to say that when we talk about being a healthy church or healthy congregations, that what we know about having healthy bodies will apply. So let's define the term health first. And let's use body kind of language. What do you know about being healthy? Or what do you believe about being healthy? What would you say, this is what it takes to be healthy? What do you need to do? Let's just get a bunch of definitions out there about being healthy.
Eat right. Parts,
function. Eat right. Are you Lutheran?
Yes.
Yeah, I see. I mean, eating is one of the things that the Lutheran Church has down. You added an adjective, or maybe it's an adverb if eat is a verb. Eat right. We'll talk about that. Okay, eat right. Somebody else said something.
Parts function.
Are there particular parts that come to mind, Paul?
I'm 62. Yeah.
Parts.
After hiking for a couple of days, you know, they. Muscles and joints and...
Okay. So what helps... I hear you alluding... I mean, you seem reluctant to say this word, but alluding to exercise.
Exercise.
What helps the parts function? How about exercise, huh? What else would you say about being healthy?
Sleep.
Okay.
My dad always said, eat right, exercise, get a good night's sleep, and think good thoughts.
Think good thoughts. I like that. There's something about interpreting the pieces and interpreting how it works. Anything else?
Laughter?
Hope.
Maybe that's similar to thinking good thoughts. But
okay, I'll put it right next to that. And somebody said laughter. You want to say more about laughter?
I think we need to have fun, and we Midwestern Lutherans take ourselves so seriously. How can we be healthy?
Mm-hmm. I've been very aware of how much, we've been in the village now just about 3 weeks, how much we laugh.
And how good we feel.
Laughter, it's true, releases endorphins. What are endorphins? They are the natural antidepressants in our body. Hormonally, laughter makes a difference. It's true. Anything else you want to say about being healthy?
Relationships.
Mm-hmm. But the parts functioning together. That we're connected.
But you'd almost have to define what is a healthy relationship. Because relationships in and of itself aren't necessarily healthy.
Okay. Take a stab at it, Tim.
Well, a healthy relationship would be one that would be codependent, would not be codependent.
Yeah, but we are not going to talk about sickness yet.
That's true.
We're trying to talk, so what is a healthy relationship?
I don't know.
An honest man.
Truthfulness and naturality.
It's truth. Relationships are truthful. Mutual. Good. Anything else? One of the things that I think we could say about relationships is in some ways the same things we've said about our bodies and keeping our bodies healthy. Relationships are fed, they are exercised, they rest, huh? Some of those, all of those places. I'm gonna throw another one in here that comes out of the world of medicine and what it means to be healthy, but I think can just steer our thoughts in another way. One of the ways that I think many of us practice being healthy is getting our inoculations. How many of you were inoculated, for example, against TB or scarlet fever, polio? What else do we inoculate? Measles?
Diphtheria.
Smallpox? Diphtheria?
Mumps, rubella.
What happens when you get an inoculation?
It hurts.
It hurts. That's the first thing that happens. That's exactly right.
It is an effort to prevent death.
Well, how does it do that?
By preventing the sickness.
By giving you some of the sickness.
You get a little sick.
It stimulates the immune system. Exactly. But Tim is going to say it hurts. I don't think we've got anything on our healthy list that doesn't hurt. And one of the reasons I wanted to start here is another one of my fears about our conversation is that instead of it being a conversation about health and healing, it would be a conversation about pain and would just glump all of pain together. From my point of view, pain is simply a message. It is neither good nor bad, could be both good and bad, but it is a message. And you need to pay attention to it, and then you need to discern. Is this pain about health, or is this pain about injury or disease? So to use Paul's example, many of us having come out of our desk jobs to the mountains, head for Holden Lake, and behold, before we're back, we hurt. We have found muscles we have not used for a long time. We may have blisters on our feet. There is pain. How many of you find exercise painful? Be honest. Okay, there you go. Exercise is painful. Is it bad pain? Should we therefore conclude that we not exercise? No, not at all. But it isn't only about exercise. I joked here that I think Lutherans have eating down. It's widely known in Lutheran circles. If you want people to come to something, whether it's a Bible study or the annual meeting or whatever, you better serve food. And if you serve food, they will come. Well, when we think about our congregations, I think it is real fair to ask the question, are we being fed? And do we know our own hunger for grace and promise? Or do we see ourselves always as the feeders, the ones who need to have the output? I come from the Midwest, where there are always farmers in the congregation. We're into production. We feed the hungry. That's the thrust of the World Hunger Appeal. Do we know ourselves also to be hungry? And are we being fed? What would it take to feed us? When I think about sleep, how could sleep be painful? I like to quote the poet Gerhard Frost. I love his poetry because he as a poet gives glimpses into very ordinary things. And he talked about a sleepless night in one of his poems. And the phrase he turned in it was, "I was babysitting the world." Sure, God is in charge of the world, but tonight I need to stay awake and look after it. I've got to do this. The gift of rest and trust in being healthy. Finally, I think inoculation is a wonderful metaphor for what healthy congregations do. We take on a little bit of disease to know that it strengthens our immune system. It hurts. But we don't so much react to that pain. We know that the risk of polio is much more serious than the risk of a reaction to the inoculation or to the germ. And we know that we're able to welcome that kind of pain. I'll just stop here to say, what have you thought about in the life of your congregation?
And add something that I think is missing.
Please.
Of what makes a healthy health. Yeah. I know people that eat right, exercise, run a whole lot, do everything on there, and they're just busy thinking, and they laugh a lot. They're just thinking about themselves. And I don't think that's a healthy person. So somewhere on there needs to be to serve others, care about others.
Okay.
Not be selfish.
Right.
Mentally.
We do have relationships on there, but you're going to say care or service, right? Think about others. Mm-hmm. There, we're on to what it means to think good thoughts, not just about yourselves.
Work as well is missing from the list, and it seems to me that when we don't have work and the joy of work, we're missing something.
Thank you.
And with that would be balance. Yeah.
Well, there are all kinds of things to balance here, aren't there?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Sleep and exercise. You can't do those at the same time. And nobody would say that to be healthy is to sleep all the time. Nobody would say that to be healthy is to exercise all the time. On the other hand, I think when we think about our congregations, that's a difficult balance. That there are sides of congregations that are busy all the time and define themselves only by their busyness. There are also sides of the congregations that are very sedentary and may define themselves by being sedentary. You know, I come here to get fuel. I absolutely hate the gas station metaphor for church because it is so mechanical, it is so passive. In my last parish, the metaphor that was abiding for me was to say, the church is not a grocery store, a supermarket. The church is a garden. In a grocery store, the fruit is always ripe, and sometimes it's cheap. In a garden, the fruit will be free, but it will come in its own time, and it needs to be nurtured and tended. Waited for. There needs to be some balance between work and sleep.
Some people don't garden because they have it takes too much work. Others because it takes too much time. You have to wait for it. And the old parable about the person who sows the seed and then sleeps night and day.
That's a great paradox. It's free, but you work.
Yeah.
I mean, mm-hmm. It is free, but yeah. You don't get much if you don't do the work.
Yeah. And is not that the paradox of health, Dan? Yeah. It's free. It's a gift. I mean, you can do all these things and still not be healthy. My brother does all these things. He is still diabetic. Health is a gift. But there are some things up here that you have. Well, lots of things that you have to work at. Balanced nutrition, exercise. Work, thoughts, focus. Go ahead.
I have a question about our list. Are we purposely... you've said many things that relate to life in the spirit, mm-hmm. but we haven't put it up there as a category yet. Mm-hmm. But and I don't know how it would be listed, but at least some sensitivity to the fact that there is unseen, often invisible, except for certain behaviors, or even then invisible, spiritual life that is foundational to health.
Why do you say unseen?
Unseen, because no one can measure the motivations of any person's action.
I think the gift of defining congregations around word and sacrament is it helps that objectivity to say that where the word is and where the sacrament is, it is there.
As life in the spirit.
Yeah, there was a very funny song that some people in my first parish used to sing about being old. And it said, you know, I wake up in the morning and read the obits, and if I'm not there, I'm still alive. You know, that being healthy is almost that elusive. That if you wake up, you've got the gift of a new day, Ed Short said in Matthew this morning.
That's true.
And on some measure, you have health. And some of why I started here is because I think that's an important focus. It's a wider focus than just looking at a particular sickness. I mean, one of my other fears is that we would come into this conversation and say the reason that the congregations aren't healthy is because of the pastors these days. If we had better pastors, we'd be healthier. There are lots of places that say that. If not explicitly, implicitly.
Or they say, when we get the new pastor.
That's right. That's it. That's the shape it takes. Then things will improve. Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, one of the reasons I started here is that I think, and I guess I already said this, we need to think a bit about pain. I mean, my most recent parish was in Southwest Minnesota. I know a number of congregations in Southwest Minnesota that are struggling to become bilingual and bicultural. There are large populations of Hispanic people moving into Southwest Minnesota and Hmong people. And that's a painful kind of thing. But I would argue is a pain of exercise, of translating the gospel into a new tongue, of becoming body of Christ again beyond ethnicity in a really healthy way. That's painful, and there is resistance to that, of course. But I hear it as the pain of life and health and growth, albeit very difficult. I lost what I was going to say. This will happen more and more.
It's painful, isn't it?
It's painful. Thank you. It's painful. But you know, I'm still alive. It was another example of... And it's a really good example. There was a cluster just southwest of New Ulm called the Prairie Lakes Cluster or something. There is a cluster of 8 congregations. Some of those congregations can see each other's steeples. I mean, you can imagine how close together these churches are. And you know what's happened in the prairie. Depopulation. I mean, there are almost more steeples than there are farms. And so these congregations have formed a cluster to do what they can do together
better than what they can do separately. And one time at one of our conference pastors' meetings, they gave a forum, and there was a voice on that forum who said, when we face the choice between our heritage and the gospel, we know what our choice needs to be, but our heritage has also been very good. In fact, now there is someone who's willing to face the pain of being alive, who's exercising movement, growth, change, saying the gospel will sustain us, but it's painful and it hurts. Our heritage has also been good. I mean, one of the things that says about being healthy that really catches this paradox is that to be healthy, frankly, you need to die. You need to die to the heritage and trust that God's going to raise a new church up. This time it's going to be a cluster of steeples on the parish for a while. And then, you know, well, we don't know what it'll be. But that's very painful. And so one of the things I wanted to say around health is that it is a willingness of churches to face the pain of dying and rising, of thinking beyond themselves, and at the same time of paying attention to themselves. I mean, of exercising and resting, eating and sharing, all of these sort of creative tensions in a way of being healthy. Do you have situations from your churches you'd like to talk about before we move to the other half of this conversation?
What you're kind of explaining from that cluster too is there, you know, the old saying, change or die. Mm-hmm. And I, in my work, I never use that with congregations as an inner pastor and media and all that sort of stuff. I use the phrase, you know, you do need to look at some change or you will miss wonderful opportunities, which is easier to take than change your diet. When in fact the congregation is facing the fact that they may not be in existence.
Yeah.
But that dying that you said, that maybe this needs to die so it can become something new. That's, that, you know, that I think is what congregations, what I'm finding congregations need to not be afraid to look at.
Right.
There's other opportunities for us. Mm-hmm. The Green Book doesn't make it all the time.
Well, yeah, there's another place we've had some pain.
Yeah.
Around our worship.
It's not an evangelistic tool.
Yeah. But I hear you pushing congregations, Tim, toward that discernment that says, Is it a pulled muscle down here after the hike? If it is, I need to stretch it out and I need to walk it out. I need to keep moving. You know, it's the only way that muscle's going to heal. Or is it broken? Because if it's broken, then I need to stop moving. And that's a very interesting discernment, and I don't think communities are ever in the same place on that. But that may be healthy. One of the things I want to say in the interest of health is if you're getting some resistance in your congregation, maybe you're doing something worth resisting.
That's very healthy.
And that's good. And if you aren't getting any resistance, maybe you're missing some opportunities. Go ahead.
I'm in a parish where we've got a new rector who's wonderful. It's led to
I'm sure that's never happened before.
And so many people have left in a short period of time within the last 5 years, and it's I'm on the vestry in the church, and we're trying to kind of work on trying to heal some of this, and it's really difficult. But we're moving in a different direction for sure.
Thank you for a very true story.
Yeah.
How true it is. Go ahead.
We recently had an ordination. We had seven folks ordained, and our preacher was pretty clear about, you know, we're not being called to ordain museum curators. But folks are going on the edge that are not as invested in maintaining institutional forms, but planting the seeds and seeing how the seeds are going to take root. This thing about honoring the heritage is so important, and yet also simultaneously saying that we are constantly reforming ourselves and growing into something that's not yet here. Very difficult. I'm in a church right now that I think we're the only, at least the only Episcopal church I've ever heard of, at least on the West Coast, that has the founding rector buried beneath our altar. and it was circa 1950.
Yeah.
You know,
when the church was
perfect.
Yeah.
You know, so
those aren't the bones of Jesus.
But there's veneration, you know, of this, it's the symbol of the time, this very, at that time, very robust, incredibly influential, powerful church. And now, you know, it's 50 plus years later, and we have, you know, 46 different languages being spoken, you know, nearby school, and this is a almost completely white parish that, you know, it's dying. So,
wow.
I'm talking about health now, but yeah. it's
powerful
what you're saying.
It's so crucial that we talk about our metaphors.
Yeah.
I'm trying to describe the church as a fitness center.
Yeah.
As a gym, you know, where people really do sweat. But I think without really being conscious of it, we sometimes describe our congregations more like nursing homes, where we make one another comfortable. Or, you know, museum curators, where we dust the old bones. And, you know, museums have their place. Memory has its place in being healthy. I started saying, let's remember that neither the church in Galatia or Corinth was totally healthy. And one of the things that I've come to talk about in terms of health and balance, you use the word balance, and we see this, you don't exercise all the time, you don't sleep all the time. So, the more I talk about balance, frankly, the more paralyzed I feel. So I don't know if I should go to bed or if I should go run. You know, because I can't do them both at the same time. I've got to get out of balance. Then sometimes it's easier to talk about imbalance and correction. So you risk breaking a leg in the hopes of having a healthier leg, and then you rest. And that both of those are healthier. That imbalance correction kind of thing. You remember and then you hope. You honor the relics and then you revision that sort of thing.
I'm presently serving a conflicted congregation that lost 37% of its membership in 2 years. Mm-hmm. And for the first couple months, I always like to put in a newsletter in the Sunday insert announcements that paraphrase, I'm available for meeting over coffee or lunch to discuss personal issues or spiritual issues, such and like. You know, and that was in there for about 2 months, and then the first four people who contacted me and came in to talk to me wanted to talk about their funeral. Nothing about the conflict, they just want to make sure their funeral is planned.
But a healthy church thinks about more than myself.
Yes.
Yeah, isn't that right? And you know, Tim, I teased him when he said, a healthy congregation is not codependent. Might be really helpful to unpack that. Codependence comes out of the world of Alcoholics Anonymous, where an alcoholic is addicted to alcohol, which on some level I see more and more as pain relief. The drug takes my pain away. The codependent is addicted to the alcoholic, to taking care of the alcoholic's pain. Codependent congregations try to take the pain away, get addicted to making it not be painful. And we will not heal, much less be healthy, as long as we do that. One of the, I do think it's important that we talk some about healing congregations. My own history as a parish pastor is that I frequently served congregations that had experienced misconduct by a predecessor pastor. The Alban Institute calls pastors like me after pastors. They're pastors who come in after the big event. And so because of that calling, I've done a lot of reading on misconduct in congregations, and I have a hunch it's one of the reasons that Christine asked me to lead this session. The Alban Institute has done some wonderful research. Marie Fortune has written a book called Is Nothing Sacred, and continues to train people to respond to this kind of brokenness. And one of the publications of the Alban Institute is called The Congregation is a Victim Too. And here, where we talked about healing, it may be helpful to think about what is the opposite of victim. The opposite of victim is a survivor. A person or a congregation is a victim as long as they define themselves by the injury that's happened. A survivor becomes a survivor when they know they have options and they know they have more ways to define themselves than simply the one event. So for example, people who have had cancer are victims of cancer. I mean, there's a way in which their own body has turned against them. And it is a violation. And it's interesting to listen to people who have had cancer, and they become very articulate about this relationship with this part of themselves that is destroying their very life. They become a survivor when they are, again, healthy enough to define themselves by more than just having had the cancer, more than having been an alcoholic, more than having been a rape victim. I mean, it is a part of their history. It's not denied, but it becomes integrated into a new understanding. Now, the first step in that, of course, is to validate the injury. A one level of the conversation with Christine when she was suggesting that I lead this session, I would have used some of St. John's language in his first chapter where he talks about full of grace and truth. That there is some relationship between truth and grace. And on the one hand, we have here the interesting kind of resistance toward pain that will in fact be healthy, that will make you stronger, that will make you more alive. One of the things that happens here when something has happened in a congregation that is really devastating, really injurious, is to know that part of the grieving process is denial, is the refusal to look at it. And that needs to be treated mercifully on a level. On another level, it needs to be treated truthfully, firmly, grace and truth. And that's a really difficult kind of edge, because not everybody will get there at the same time. There'll be some people who'll be preoccupied with the incident, want to talk about nothing but the incident. There are other people who want to talk about everything but the incident, and there'll be all kinds of people all aware in between. I mean, some people want to talk only about those bones under the altar. Some people want to talk about anything but the bones under the altar. And then there are all kinds of places in between. And, you know, the truth is never in one extreme or the other, but it is in somehow this bumpy movement forward that allows people to talk about the violation, whatever the violation may have been, also allows people to say, we have options, and we have other ways to define ourselves. We define ourselves along good eating, both literally and metaphorically, that we feast on the promise of a gospel that has fed communities that were broken and distorted and victimized from the very beginning. And it really is more powerful. last spring, I'll just tell a concrete story because I think sometimes that spurs more clarity. A pastor resigned from a parish in our synod, admitted to misconduct. It was sexual misconduct. And so was not only removed from the call, but was removed from the ELCA clergy roster. The practice of our denomination is that with such a violation, pastor must be removed from service, and then after 5 years can be considered for reinstatement. As a firm kind of way of saying that we must stand in solidarity with people who've been victimized. This sort of trust cannot be perpetuated and isn't healed without some intentionality. And so one of the synod ministers in our synod was going over for another forum in the congregation to give people in the congregation an opportunity to talk. And nobody else was willing to go, and the synod is learning that you just don't go alone. So they asked me if I would go to be a recorder, to be a support kind of person, to simply to be an observer to the event. And it was a real learning moment for me, having, as I told you, served in congregations that have had this history. To watch a congregation as it comes to that awareness that this one they had trusted had violated them. And frankly, to listen to the refusal to believe, to the refusal to even go there, to the sort of defensiveness. And I'd read all the books. I knew that was part of the reaction, but it was really something to hear it firsthand. I don't know if in the midst of this tragedy you can be responsive to the humor, but I was sitting facing the folks so I could see them like I am today. And my colleague was standing at a podium leading this discussion. I'm taking notes, writing down the questions, things kind of thing. I'm here to tell you, I heard words that I have never heard in a Lutheran church basement before. I mean, I'm sitting there looking at these people who are all looking just like you. You know, these same kind of stoic, not giving too much away on their faces kind of thing. And I hear my colleague say the words genital manipulation. I've never heard that in a church basement before. And what was amazing to me is that not a single face changed. Not a single face changed.
That's Lutheran, though.
It's also victimization. And shock. Maybe it's emotional shock. I mean, my sense is, you know, when something physically, I think Paul is right. Our systems are bodies, and we can learn a lot from our bodies. When something is too painful for our body, the defense mechanism is we go into shock. We don't feel the pain. And in that moment, people can do incredible things. They get back from Lyman Lake on a sprained ankle. You know, by not feeling the pain, it just, the pain is too much and they shut down. And I think the same thing happens emotionally. When it's too painful, you just don't feel it. And I don't think Lutherans have a corner on it, Kristen. I mean, we've got it. But anybody who's faced that kind of violation has it. And the other things we learn from our body is it's a defense mechanism that's okay for a while. But if you don't somehow get out of shock, you can die from it. And emotionally, that's true, too. I mean, it needs to be felt. And interim pastors need a lot of support when they go to allow the telling of the story, the kind of opening up of the brokenness that nobody ever sees exactly alike. I think John has got it right. The words in the right order, it is grace and truth. Led by grace to say, we can talk about this. and our brokenness can come to the surface, and we will be healed. This will be a healing kind of place. Are there situations or questions, things that you've thought about in this? Go ahead.
I think your example of the cancer victim or survivor is very applicable. Mm-hmm. My brother-in-law had pancreatic cancer operation a year ago and is still alive, which is quite a surprise, very weak. But in Vancouver, Washington, they have a cancer survivor meeting, and even though he's still pretty weak to get there, my mm-hmm. sister and he get over there, because it's all the things you're talking about. These are all survivors. There's no victim talk at all. They are given specific information that helps them with whatever is their big deal. They share their stories. They find out they're not alone. And then they learn, what can we do next? And they all go home with a rose. Everybody that comes home comes with a rose. They've got hope.
Wouldn't it be great if our congregations could do that? Mm-hmm. You know, that if we could all come together and say, you know, we all have these warps and injuries, but we're survivors by God's grace. And so we can tell the truth about what we're afraid of and what we're hurting and what we need. And go ahead, Kristen.
So what, in your experience, Paul, is needed in these congregations that have experienced that kind of boundary violation and are in pain or denial or whatever? What do you bring to them? What is needed in the leadership position from the pastor, and what is needed for healing?
What is needed for healing? That's a very fair question. And the first word that comes to my mind is perseverance and the capacity not to overreact. I mean, one of the things that helped me most in the literature was to say that one of the things that characterizes a congregation that has been injured is disproportionate anger. And it almost always comes out sideways. For one thing, the person to whom the anger would be directed is no longer there. So it often comes out at the new pastor. Or it comes out about some other kind of decision that proves to this person that the church really is going to hell in a handbasket. And here it comes, and it's not about that. It's not about the wallpaper border in the bathroom. And whether I think when the violation is sexual, that's particularly true, but the other area of which this is often true is financial. And it's a matter of, allowing that anger to come. And it's a costly ministry. But in the same way that grief support groups do that for one another, we know that when people are grieving, they're often angry, even at the person who died. And that makes sense on a level, and it doesn't make sense on another level, but it's just real. And sometimes the anger is directed at the perpetrator. A lot of times that anger is self-directed. And then it's really toxic. It's depressing. But can't come out. I think laughter, the antidote to that is laughter. And laughter invites us into our capacity to heal again. Ben, in Ben's session last night on ritual humor, described it as the drill bit that bores to the sacred. Humor helps us. It disarms us. Helps us get there, but it takes a lot of perseverance. And I think that, it just takes a lot of time. I mean, some of the research is saying it takes a congregation a full generation to recover. And so, you know, one of the things that I use when I'm talking to people in any kind of emotional recovery is metaphor to say, no, what would you say to yourself if you broke your leg? How soon would you get up and walk? Well, you know, probably at least 6 weeks in a cast, right? And then how many weeks of therapy after that? Now, when you've lost something even more substantial than a broken leg, what does our culture say about how long it takes? You know, we don't necessarily appreciate that time. I'm coming at this sideways, Kristen. I think people need perseverance, acceptance of an anger and raw emotion, time. Then maybe that's a horrible cliche. More than time, the grace that is the freedom in time to express some of that emotion. I think what you said speaks a lot. I think those congregations constantly need that focus beyond themselves. The serenity prayer that says, I'm not going to heal this. I'm not going to be able to get there, but God will. God is faithful and God raises the dead. And to hear this in death resurrection kind of language. Tim, was there something you would add to that?
Well, I'm thinking about Edwin Freeman's quote that says, unresolved anxiety in one generation will be acted out in another. Mm-hmm. So if the truth-telling isn't done after whatever happens in the congregation, it will come back again.
Yeah.
And when you go into a highly anxious congregation, and anxiety is not a bad thing, and we can talk about that at a later date, but a highly anxious congregation, what I find is, you know, people in their anxiety say, well, how long are you going to be here, and when can we get the real pastor, and we're all ready to move on now, thank you, you know, so then, well, you're not, because the truth hasn't been told. And I did a timeline exercise with a congregation, older congregation that was celebrating their 100th anniversary, and thank goodness there were these two sisters who had grown up in that congregation. They were still there, and they were born and baptized there in the 20s, and they kind of remember the story, but no one ever asked them. But in charting out all the pastors that they had, we ran into this one, I think it was six or seven pastors in a row, that they were there for 3 years, and then they were let go. 3 years fired, 3 years fired, 3 years fired, 3 years fired. And nobody knew why. Okay, and these two sisters, you know, popped up and said, oh, they were all alcoholics, they were all drinkers. But this congregation had a habit of 21 years of hiring alcoholics. Okay, and the sad part is, the interesting part is they hired one of them back. The second one, they fired him, and then about three people down, they hired him back again. You know, and they didn't understand the fact that they had some stuff here that they had never dealt with. And there were members there that remembered all these past, like, oh my God. Oh yes, now I remember, you know, oh, I didn't know that. So unresolved anxiety in one generation will be acted out in another. So if that truth isn't dealt with over a period of time, it's going to creep back in some other form, and again, you're going to go into the unhealthy aspect.
Friedman's book is called Generation to Generation, it is a classic. He took family systems, psychology, and applied it to congregations. And the other language that would give me for perseverance is non-anxious presence. And one of the things that I think could be a helpful thing to move toward as we need to close, that I really appreciate about Friedman and a systems approach, is that when it comes to anxiety in a system, anybody can help it by managing their own anxiety. And what ends up happening is we become very aware of somebody else's anxiety, and we think, you know, if they wouldn't overreact so much, we'd all be a lot happier. When the truth is, any one of us who can manage not to react and to be calm, steadfast, can help the whole, you know, the whole system calm down and breathe. We didn't put breathing under health. That is an important piece of breathing. And in some ways, one of the things that, to use inoculationism, imagination helps us go to places and feel the pain and practice not being anxious.
Any type of change or transition in your life or in any system, like a family or a congregation, there's going to be anxiety. The issue isn't that you don't have anxiety. The issue is health, and a healthy system is one that learns how to manage their anxiety.
Yeah.
Not avoid it. Anxiety is going to be there. How do you manage your anxiety?
Yeah. Go ahead. There was a, you're back here. You have a chance.
I just wondered if there can ever be a negative connotation with survivor. I'm a part of a congregation that's been through a series of broken relationships with pastors. Just in the past month, we've asked our no longer current pastor to leave. And an attitude that has frustrated me in the church has been the statement, well, we're survivors. We can make it, you know, we've seen pastors come and go, and we can make it through this. Am I reacting incorrectly to that statement to make that make me bristle, or can there be a negative aspect of surviving?
Just, I think one of the things that I hear in what you're saying is you're responding not only to what is being said, but to the way it's being said. That some of that language, I think, functions to keep us from dealing with it. You know, that when we say we're survivors, and people use a lot of pious language that way, God will get us through, which says, I don't have to really deal with this. I'm not telling you what I'm really feeling. And so I think you're right. I mean, I think any of this language could be corrupted in a way to say I don't have to really deal with it.
Or even to perpetuate it so we don't have to relinquish our identity as survivors.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. And so, I mean, the interesting thing is there is a real appropriate time to say I am a victim. I did not choose this. I didn't want this. I have feelings about that. And you may be closer to becoming what is meant by survivor by claiming the truth about that victimization. So it's not an either or, but it's rather descriptive of a movement. And I think if you refuse ever to look at this, you aren't going to be that. In the same way as if you pretend you don't have cancer or pretend you know that alcoholism isn't part of your family, I mean, you're not ever going to get
so,
to that.
So
place.
How do we help people acknowledge that? I mean, one of the things that I'll hear people say is, well, he left because of this, and he left because of this, and it was a different reason for this person, and it was a different, you know, they're all different situations, they're all unique. It's not really us, it's them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How do we...
Us versus them.
Yeah.
How do you respond to someone like that, or what do you? How do we get at the truth in looking at our own participation or role in being a? You know, I hate to say that we, you know, as a congregation, we caused our own victimization, but I think when it's happened that many times,
you have a role.
It seems like we must be doing something wrong.
Right. One of the things that I think is important is to validate what's being said. To say, you're right. Each of these situations on some levels was different. There's truth in that. I mean, for sure, that would be true. But it seems to me there are some other pieces we ought to look at. And it's really curious. You can't force somebody to look at something they don't want to look at. I mean, you can't, and the harder you force it, the more defensive they will be.
And the answers or the study or the look could take almost a generation, could take years.
Yeah.
I know congregations that go through, it takes three or four interim pastors coming in or over here, trained interim pastors to really get it to a spot, you know. And sometimes they will even after one or two interims, get a pastor in that. And the pastors, the healthy ones come in knowing that they're going to be short term because the issues aren't done yet. Okay, and then you bring in another interim. So it just sometimes will take a while.
I can give you a personal example that may be illustrative. I have a nephew who was born with spina bifida and a herniated diaphragm. The day he was born, he was given a 1 in 5 chance to live. But he lived. And he does really amazingly well. But my mom is very anxious about the challenges he faces and has a need to say, it's really hard and it's really awful. It took me a long time to figure out that I got further with my mom by saying, yep, it's really hard. Than by saying, but he does really good. What I wanted to say is,
But he does really good, because he does do really better than we could have ever hoped on some levels. On the other hand, it is hard. And for Grandma, that just is where it is at this moment. And if I can give her that, then there are times she's able to see how well he does, too. And so it, that's where there's this corporate kind of all these eyes looking at it, and 500 eyes are never going to all see it the same way. I'm not very good at this, frankly. I would be a person who would try to force the examination. And maybe one of the reasons God has given me the path God gave me is to learn to accept it as it comes, as opposed to attempting to force it.
I think much of what we've been talking about is a great argument for making persistent use of interim pastorates. I think that the gift of being an interim pastor is that you know you're not going to be there forever. So when there are storms or strange things that seem to come out of the left field and you can't figure it out, you know that you're not in it, you're not stuck there.
Yeah.
So you can cope with it, you can deal with it, you can be non-defensive, and less anxious, simply because you know you're there for a while. And I think it also frees up members of the congregation to be a little more honest, because they know you're going to be gone. So they can speak a little more freely, knowing that you're going to disappear in a year or less.
I think that's the ideal, Dan. The flip side of this is if it in fact takes generations, the next pastor still needs to be prepared.
Sure.
And needs to attempt to be non-anxious. Several people have comments I want to hear from you.
I guess the sadness I see, I'm fairly new to the Lutheran Church, and this is the first time, this is our first congregation, the first time our pastor has left. I find it really sad that as a congregation, somehow, some way, we couldn't enfold the pastor, really, when I reflect on it, instead of, you know, you're out of here. And looking at the habit that this congregation has, that, you know, these are people in crisis. Mm-hmm. And if we're really following our word, then we would enfold them and help them and hopefully come to the conclusion that, yes, we want you and need you to stay, or mutually decide, you know what, our relationship is at its end, and we'll need to move on, just as you would in a personal relationship one-on-one. Is this a Lutheran habit or something? I mean, I grew up in the Catholic Church, and the priest you got, I mean, he was there forever until he either died or something. You never knew, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, they moved on. But in the 8 years I grew up in the Catholic grade school, we had the same priest.
Well.
That, not saying that was good, but I'm now at this other end of the spectrum. And
You know, the thing that happens in the Catholic Church, I mean, it's sort of where the responsibility is. I mean, it's pretty clear that when the responsibility is with the bishops to deal with pastors who have issues, that doesn't automatically happen. As Lutherans, we've taken on that responsibility as congregations, that the call comes from the congregation. Congregation needs to deal with issues. It isn't automatic there either, that it will happen. And what's beneath all of this is that's what the world did to Jesus, too. It is what we do to truth. We crucify the truth because we fail to see the grace that's in it. The good news is that God endures that. God is still faithful to people who crucify the truth. And so it's much broader than Lutherans.
The quote that I shared with you from two leading experts in conflict resolution in the church, Speed Lees from the Alvin Institute and Peter Snagy, both of which do conflict resolution. And both of them have stated on two different occasions, I've heard them say that 30 to 40% of all churches are in some level of conflict. All churches, all denominations, and denominations, you know, and the percentage is increasing. So it's not just Lutherans.
Or see, and I think that's bigger than the church. I think we are in a paradigm kind of shift. We are in transition on lots of levels. What we believed was the right privilege, pursuit of happiness, of being American privilege is breaking down and probably needs to break down because it's inherently unjust. What happens to people in transition? They get anxious. Where do they have power? Do they use the power to enfold? Sometimes. I mean, it's amazing. We do need to bring this to close. One of the things that I want to do in closing is to say, no matter where you are here or what you may need to heal from, do not neglect your own wisdom and the Bible's vision for what it is to be healthy. I'm a campus pastor now, and young adults, of course, are testing. I joke with the whole campus community that I think most of them come to college believing in the health of a good night's sleep, but they quickly get over it. Students do not sleep. It is just amazing. Last year, I spent a good chunk of the year counseling a young man who was having terrible issues with internet pornography, and he hated himself for it. But after months of conversation, I discovered a correlation. He's also broke. What else is new on a college campus? But he convinces himself he can't afford to eat. And when he goes a week without eating, all of those issues flare up. And when he's well, now here's good news for Lutherans. When he's well fed, he had a healthy capacity to resist. And I think when we're making, the term we use in our tradition is vigorous use of the means of grace. When we read about these congregations in the Bible who kept kicking their pastors out, kept kicking the word out, the truth out, and God yet sustained them, God raised them from the dead, I think it goes a long ways. When we know finally we're all hungry for grace, it's not some them that's hungry, we're all hungry. And maybe all a little reluctant to exercise, if the truth be known. It hurts. I've got blisters on my toes as I speak. It hurts. But to keep this vision, because even no matter how conflicted you are, a good night's sleep is a good idea. And you know, maybe we'll look at it in the morning. Have a better perspective in the morning. There is so much wisdom in health that is dynamic in and of itself and healing in and of itself that we lose sight of when we start to be disease-focused. I would want us not to be disease-focused. Finally, I have a wonderful quotation that I'll offer in closing by Deschardins, the French Roman Catholic. Above all, trust in the slow work of God. We are quite naturally impatient in everything to reach the end without delay. We should like to skip the intermediate stages. We are impatient of being on the way to something unknown, something new. And yet it is the law of all progress that it is made by passing through some stages of instability and that it may take a very long time. And so I think it is with you. Your ideas mature gradually. Let them grow. Let them shape themselves without undue haste. Don't try to force them on, as though you could be today what time and grace will make you tomorrow. Only God could say what this new spirit gradually forming within you will be. Give our Lord the benefit of believing that His hand is leading you, and accept the anxiety of feeling yourself in suspense and incomplete. Yeah, in suspense and incomplete, you know? We're hungry now, it's lunchtime. We'll be hungry again tomorrow.